I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. You need not share the author's appreciation and adoration of Judy Garland to enjoy the book, My Judy Garland Life by Susie Boyd. It's a remarkable memoir that was a Globe and Mail Book of the Year and a critical hit here in Canada and in the United States and in Britain. It's a wonderful mix of a memoir of how the author grew up adoring Judy Garland, admiring her talent, enjoying her work, and examining the less than glamorous aspects of the legendary film, television, and stage performer who is arguably, according to Ms. Boyd, the greatest entertainer of the 20th century or any century. The author joins me now from London, England, just as the book has been published in soft cover. If you haven't read it, it's definitely worth reading. It's a serviceable biography of Garland, as well as a marvelous meditation on fame and hero worship. Susie Boyd is a novelist, part-time bereavement counselor, and columnist for the Financial Times. Her great-grandfather was Sigmund Freud. Her website is at susieboyd.com. The book is published by Bloomsbury. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Susie Boyd. Good morning, Ms. Boyd.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. As I said off the top, I really enjoyed this book. It made me think about when I first encountered Judy Garland. I grew up admiring and idolizing Frank Sinatra. And from that, I was introduced to that sort of music. I remember first encountering Judy Garland in that special that she did with Sinatra and Dean Martin. You remember that one?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. When was it for you that you first encountered Judy Garland?
Well, like a lot of people, I came to her first through The Wizard of Oz, which was the first film that I ever went to see. And I remember my mother took me to it with quite some ceremony, saying, "We've got to go and see this film." And she'd, in fact, been taken to it by her mother the year it came out, 1939. And so I wasn't particularly wanting to go to a film, you know, the way your parents' choices always sort of grate slightly. And so I went in a slightly grumpy frame of mind. I was probably between 3 and 5. And there was just a sort of instant connection when I heard Judy Garland singing Over the Rainbow. I was so moved by it, and I was a very, very sensitive child, and people were always saying to me, "You've got to toughen up. You can't go around life having all these feelings the whole time. You've got to grow an extra layer of skin or you're just not going to have a happy life." And so I had this idea that I was this very sort of soppy, almost emotional child who wasn't quite made for this world, but, you know, quite hard to know what to do with that information when you're 4 years old. And when I saw Judy Garland singing Over the Rainbow, I thought, here is someone who seems to be as sensitive as I am, and she's not ashamed of it, and she's, no one's telling her off about it. It's sort of the best thing about her, and this sensitivity has sort of made her into a star. And it was, you know, the best possible news I could imagine, that that rather than this terrible affliction I had of, you know, always bursting into tears and being cut to the quick by anything, you know, anyone said, that maybe that could actually be the sort of making of me. So it was just a sort of wonderful smash of recognition and fellow feeling and sort of connection.
And later on, from learning about Garland and her life, did you learn to toughen up?
I have toughened up, luckily. I think a lot of that comes through just growing older. I mean, I think when I was 4 or 5, I imagined the problems that I saw adults in their 20s, 30s, and 40s having, and imagined that I would have to deal with them with a 4-year-old's emotional strength, financial resources, kind of connections, whatever. And it didn't occur to me that when you moved house in your 30s, you know, you would be strong enough to carry lots of suitcases, or you would maybe have a job and have an income and that kind of thing. I somehow forgot that an older person would be sort of stronger in many, many ways that at 4 you're not, you know. And so I was really glad to see that that was true.
you mentioned going to see The Wizard of Oz. Did you watch a lot of Judy Garland films growing up?
I did. I mean, I saw them. We didn't really have a VHS or obviously DVD player till until I was much, much older, but I watched them whenever they came on the television, and if they were late at night. I think because I was such a swot at school and gave my schoolwork my all, my mum always let me, you know, take the morning off if there was a, you know, if A Star Is Born was on at midnight or something. So that was kind of her.
Did you want to go into show business?
I sort of did. I wanted to so much, and at the same time also knowing that it wasn't possible. So the two sort of things ran together in a funny way. there's a bit in my book where I imagine kind of how wonderful it would be to be the star, and then think, well, it'd be quite good to be the in the chorus, and it would be quite good to be the makeup lady, and it'd be quite nice to be the man at the stage door, and the woman who sweeps the stage, and the person who sells the ice creams. I think I found that whole world very, very alluring.
Your father met Judy Garland, right?
Yes, they met at some, I think it was a premiere in London for A Star Is Born, which would have been in the mid-50s, or they shook hands, and when they shook hands, his hand connected with only her first four fingers. Her little finger was left out of the handshake, and she called him back and said, "Hey, you missed one," and then they shook hands again.
Yeah.
So he's actually shaken hands with her twice.
Yeah, your father's a notable artist, right?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a wonderful line in the book where you talk about him recounting that story. And as a child, you had him do that a lot, right?
Yes. I used to watch quite a lot of court shows on TV where people gave, the witness had to testify to the barrister. And I know that they always asked the people the same question again and again and again, hoping that sometimes more details would emerge. So I kept saying, "And what happened then? And what happened then?"
Was it Judy Garland that you wanted to know, the one that you thought she was, and subsequent to growing up, did you find out that she was the same person, or was she completely different than what you imagined or yearned for as a child?
It's so hard to know, because as you perhaps felt with your interest in idolization of Sinatra, one brings a lot of oneself into these sorts of relationships, and so in a way, someone like Judy Garland or like Frank Sinatra, it's perfectly possible and almost impossible not to bring a great deal of oneself into the relationship. And so I suppose I focused on aspects of her that sort of made sense to me. And I knew from a very young age that her life had been almost impossibly difficult, but somehow that made everything she had achieved seem so much more valuable and exciting. I didn't, as a child, sort of dwell on quite why her life was as difficult as it was, but I felt that it made her a sort of bigger, better person and more, more inspiring in a way.
And how much of how you admire her comes from the fact that she did have this tortured childhood that perhaps we as fans may have caused the grief in her life?
It's hard to know the relationship between what fans appreciate, what they require, what they demand, what they sort of force from a person. I'm not quite sure how those kind of equations work, but I feel that in the book, on a few occasions, I sort of imagine, had I been in her circle, what I could have done to help. And I don't feel that I would. I talk about good fans and bad fans, and I hope I would have always been available to give any kind of help. But I didn't. I wouldn't have made my wanting to help her some sort of need that would be thrust on her. I just, I don't know. I suppose there's something about Judy Garland where she, throughout her performances and the way she lived her life, she sort of gave her absolute all. And we know that stars who give their all, and even people who absolutely give their all, don't make old bones generally. They don't go on forever. And I suppose they're the short sort of intense burst of her life, and the part of me that was drawn to her very, very, very strong feelings, which I felt that I also had. I know that's all sort of connected, but I haven't quite got to the bottom of it yet.
Yeah. Do you think she knew that she was beloved as she was?
She definitely couldn't have failed to know how admired she was. But I suppose there are all those sort of slightly cliche performers things about you have 108,000 people on Boston Common sort of screaming at how wonderful you are, and yet you haven't quite got anyone to go home with, and that kind of thing. I mean, I suppose you sort of popular psychologists now say that if you mistake that kind of love of the stadium for the same kind of love of someone, making sure you've got enough covers on you at night if the weather turns chilly or whatever. I mean, it's just sort of, it's different, and extremely famous people do seem to find it very, very harrowing, don't they? And I don't know whether the fame makes you nuts, or it's being nuts that makes you become that famous, or it's a sort of it's complicated. I mean, I think she knew she was utterly adored by her fans, and at the same time sort of felt unloved, which seems, it seems to me quite easy to imagine someone feeling both those things. And conversely, for the people in her close circle, I don't know how you would make someone feel as loved as 108,000 people screaming at you that you're wonderful. You know, how do you sort of compete with that as someone's, you know, family or partner or whatever? I mean, it's a very tall order, isn't it?
Yeah. And now, if you could hurl yourself back in time, where would you go in the life of Judy Garland if you could possibly be with her as you've imagined over the years?
Well, I suppose sometimes I think I'd like to have been at the Carnegie Hall concert, which everyone who was there, you know, people say it was the best night in show business ever, and, you know, the toughest, most cynical people in the front row were completely reduced to tears. People were lying down in the aisles, completely forgetting their names, and, you know, and it was just everything went, it was one of those nights where absolutely everything went right. So I would have loved to have been there. And sometimes I think I would have liked to have been at more sort of low-key things. I talk about a dry cleaner's shop that's opposite the place she lived towards the end of her life, the last few months of her life, and the dry cleaner shop is still there, and I actually use that dry cleaner sometimes, and sometimes I imagine just being a sort of helpful, friendly, well-meaning person in the dry cleaners who would, you know, do everything really quickly and make it clear that, you know, if she needed any shopping or whatever, I would have been happy to get it. Or sometimes I think I'd have liked to be there at the sort of high moments, and other times I think just at sort of, you know, when things weren't going so well, just to be a sort of a nice, helpful person to be called on.
Some people have looked at this book with curiosity because you talk candidly about, as you said, going to the dry cleaning shop and wondering what it was like then. Do you suppose that when people ask if this adulation is normal, are you offended by that, but perhaps?
I'm not really. I suppose, you know, people who know me well know me that I've always loved Judy Garland, but I suppose there are lots of other aspects to my life, and it hasn't been, it's never been a kind of interest or obsession that sort of stunted me. You know, it's not like an addiction. I never stole money from my mother's purse to sort of buy Judy Garland records in the middle of the night from the man on the corner, or it's never had a, I can see that people sometimes want and like to feel that it's a bit dicey, a bit embarrassing, and, you know, and it is sort of slightly embarrassing to have a very, very strong feeling for someone who you don't know. But I wanted to investigate that in the book, and I feel that society thinks that hero worship is something that belongs to the sadder members of the community who don't have any sort of real life. And I have got a lot of real life, but I just felt that maybe hero worship can be done with sort of intelligence and style, and it doesn't have to be this, you know, very a lower version of real feeling, a lower version of real life. So I wanted to sort of champion it a bit, and obviously I've investigated the aspects of it that people find, you know, sad with a capital S. But I feel almost none of us, all of us, have had a kind of person in our life who's made a difference at a difficult juncture, whether it be a lovely lady on the corner who smiled at you on the way home from school when your mother was a bit busy, or a footballer, or, you know, someone like that who just thinking about became a sort of pleasurable thing. I think it's probably the minority of people who haven't had those feelings. It's just that everyone else, as someone said to me recently, yes, but I grew out of it. And I suppose I've sort of kept it going a bit just because it was a sort of a lovely, pleasurable thing. I met someone recently who was obsessed with a British footballer called Glenn Hoddle, and when his parents were going through a really, really messy, horrible divorce, just watching Glenn Hoddle playing football every Saturday just really made an enormous difference to him, and he just imagined Glenn on the football pitch, somehow knew what he was going through, and he created a kind of situation that made his life much more bearable than it would have been otherwise, which just seems such a wonderful feat of imagination in a way.
And you still find yourself turning to Judy Garland in times of joy and grief?
Well, I suppose my life is much less full of ups and downs now, but after writing the book, I did feel quite embarrassed about it, and somehow I remember being in a cake decorating shop and Over the Rainbow came on, and I sort of froze because I thought, I can't just, you know, shop to this incredible tune kind of thing. And everything that had attracted her to me, particularly the sort of heightened feeling and the sense that I got from her that the people who feel the most strongly are the sort of best people in the world, it then became so heightened that my sensitivity to it became so high that it was almost unbearable to listen to it for about a year. But very luckily, I've sort of come through that, and now you know I can have her singing in the room, and it it doesn't freak me out anymore.
And what is your favorite Judy Garland record? If you could name one or two.
Well, I suppose I don't think it's her best, but I grew up listening to a record called The Young Judy Garland, which really reminds me of those times and those sort of bittersweet struggles that I had then. And then, obviously, the Carnegie Hall album is completely faultless, and the way the songs are planned, the way they're next to each other, the overture, just everything about it is so sort of high-spirited. I love the sort of patter she has between the two songs, the two stories she tells, one about going to a very, very fancy Parisian hairdresser who's and another story about having to have a pin in her dress because it was too tight and what happened when she sat on it. And
yeah.
I find that album just almost like watching a film. And I do like the album of the Star Is Born film as well. That's probably my favourite Judy Garland film, and so I love listening to that and thinking about having watched that film at various points in my life and what I was feeling then and how I feel about it now.
I ransacked my iPod looking for Judy Garland records, and I think her recording of Smile is possibly the best of that song ever, and a lot of people have recorded it, right?
Yeah, no, that is wonderful. And when I listen to that, I think, how can we still like this song that tells us to smile though our heart is breaking? I mean, is there a single person on the world who thinks that's a good idea anymore? But when you listen to that song, you do feel it's a good idea, which is, you know, quite a feat of singing and acting in a way.
Yeah. And the other record that I really love is her version of Poor Butterfly from the TV show.
Right, I don't know that one, actually.
Yeah, I saw it
on
YouTube.
Can you sing that for me?
My voice at 3 a.m. here in Vancouver is not it's no. not up to it, but yeah. And then, of course, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. I mean, that's the quintessential Christmas song for me.
That's so wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
I really, really, really love that. For some people, it's just too sad, and, of course, you know that the initial lyrics were much, much sadder, and she just said, we can't have this, it's just going to make everyone too miserable, but it's so moving, and also when she sings it, it's a sort of older sister singing to a little sister trying to sort of cheer her up, and she's just, the Judy Garland character has just become engaged, and so she's obviously sort of singing a song about the end of her childhood as well, and it's just so, so moving.
When you met people like Mickey Rooney and Liza Minnelli, did you perhaps get a sense of who she was? Did they validate your feelings about who she was, perhaps?
It's very, very complicated how those people feel about her, I think, because they would have been through so much that was good and so much that was bad with her. I think I'm also, because I'm polite, I wouldn't ever meet a very big star and want to talk about another one, because it's just, you know, that would drive anybody nuts, wouldn't it? So
yeah.
I also feel they've both talked about her so much that, you know, there's nothing else for them to say in a way. So what I did when I met them was just try and sort of have as nice a time as possible and get a sense of them. When I met Mickey Rooney, I have to say I haven't ever met anyone who's grumpier, but I just wasn't getting anywhere. And then right at the end, I suddenly thought maybe we could sing a song, and I asked him. I thought, we've got nothing to lose, and we did, and that sort of made the meeting. And now I think if you ever meet anyone really, really famous and they're being difficult, ask if they'll sing a song with you, because I think that's the way into these relationships, and I think people would much rather do that than answer a difficult question. So that's my tip for all you star lovers out there.
Yeah, what do your daughters think of her?
They like her very much. My 9-year-old likes Julie Andrews. We went to see her in London the week before last, and I was very proud. Last Christmas, we were in Oxford Street doing Christmas shopping, and she said, Mum, do you see that guy over there? And I said, yes. And she said, do you think he's got a bit of a look of a young Mickey Rooney? And I thought, is there any other 9-year-old in London who would say that? And
yeah.
I loved that she said a young Mickey Rooney as well, like, you know, not a mid-period Mickey Rooney kind of thing. And so I think they, you know, I feel like they're growing up with a love of musical film and musical theatre, and I can't see that it's going to do them a great deal of harm.
You wonder in the book what it would have been like for Freud to meet Judy Garland.
Well, I do, just because lots of the early psychoanalysts did go from Vienna and Germany to Hollywood, and people that Freud knew well, and one person who he knew particularly well was her analyst briefly. So, her stories about her analysis are sort of complicated and sort of hard to know how true they are. But when I was on the radio in Ireland recently, they asked me what Sigmund Freud would say if he read my book and what he would think of my love stroke obsession with Judy Garland, and I thought that he would shake his head and say, "Well, I have heard verse."
Since the book's come out and it's now in soft cover and paperback, have people close to her, like her children, have they contacted you? What did they think of the book?
They haven't, and I think that I wouldn't expect them to, because I think that they're anyone being overly interested in your parents, whether they're famous or not, is always really, really annoying. And I think that, but something exciting did happen, which was I recently got an email from Barry Manilow, and he invited me to lunch because he'd loved the book so much. He's a huge Judy Garland fan, and so I went along. I wasn't completely sure who Barry Manilow was. I knew his music a bit, but when I described him to my husband, he said, "The person you think you're meeting is Lionel Richie." So I had to make some major adjustments. But anyway, we met, and he was really lovely. And he said that he'd been reading the book on an aeroplane, and he'd liked it so much he started walking up and down the plane reading it out to everyone on the plane, which was very flattering, till I thought that there were probably only three people on this plane anyway. But I had lunch with him, and he was absolutely lovely. And we talked about her for 4 hours, and he was doing a big concert in London that night. And I said to him, "Do you not have to go and do a sound check now or something?" And he said, "Oh, yes, I probably should now." But it was lovely having that.
I'll bet, yeah.
Sort of Judy lunch with him.
Yeah. Does that surprise you that there are a lot of fans like him, perhaps, and not so famous even?
I knew there were a lot of fans. I mean, I think people don't really like reading about the idea of being a fan, because it's a sort of private thing, and as it's sort of been considered slightly outlawed by society, people feel sort of, because being a fan is often to do with one's more fragile sides of one's personality, that the whole thing makes people sort of fragile about it. But I have had some wonderful letters from Judy fans.
I could go on singing. That was her last movie, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that the movie that perhaps captures her the best in those final years?
It's hard to know. Of course, she didn't make that many movies in her final years. Some very strong Judy Garland fans feel it wasn't a good idea for her to make that it sort of caricatured what people felt about her. And, you know, some reviews by even quite distinguished people say that, you know, she wasn't acting, she was just being herself, which seems really sort of naive. But I do find the film very moving, and the performances of her as playing the singer Jenny Bowman at the London Palladium are, you know, I know some Judy Garland fans who played the sort of people in the audience, because they called on all the old fan club members. This is before my time in 1962, I think, and they all went to the recordings, and they said it was just completely magical, and they loved being there.
What did you make of Judy Davis's portrayal of her?
I've only watched bits of it. I thought it was very, very competent, but something in me didn't quite want to watch it. I'm not really sure why. I didn't really give it a proper chance. I know everyone thinks it was, you know, extraordinary. I'm not quite sure how Anne Hathaway is going to fare.
Yeah, that's the next big thing, right?
Yeah, although I don't think they have a director or a script yet, so without those two things, something's a long way away from being filmed, isn't it?
Susie, this has been such a great conversation to have. I've enjoyed reading the book, and it's been such a pleasure to talk today.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks very much. The website for more is susieboyt.com. The book is called My Judy Garland Life, a Memoir. It's published by Bloomsbury. Susie Boyt, its author, on the line from London. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.